WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, in for Terry Gross. Science is unraveling the cloak of anonymity. We now know that each of us leaves an indelible trail of evidence that leads unerringly to ourselves. Unique markers include fingerprints, DNA, retinal patterns, and, if you believe Don Foster, our words. Don Foster is a professor of English literature at Vassar College. A technique he developed identified William Shakespeare as the author of a previously unidentified poem that brought him controversy and celebrity, and they, in turn, brought him a series of more modern literary mysteries, from the Unabomber to The Night Before Christmas. Don Foster says, "We are what we read. Give anonymous offenders enough verbal rope and column inches, and they will hang themselves for you every time." Professor Foster has assembled a casebook titled Author Unknown on the Trail of Anonymous, and he joins us from New York. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be with you.
You write that the unlikely path from Shakespeare to literary forensics turned on a misprint?
Well, as a graduate student at the University of California some years ago, I was researching an old literary conundrum, Master W.H., to whom Shakespeare's sonnets are dedicated, and had to look at everything published by the stationer who published that document, and found another text by a W.S., common initials, but who nevertheless seemed to know his Shakespeare pretty well, and that put me on an entirely different tack of research.
Well, W.H. is sort of the grassy knoll of Shakespearean scholarship that has led to any number of theories ranging that Shakespeare's work were in fact written by Francis Bacon to Queen Elizabeth.
Whole libraries have been written on the question of who was W.H. Was he the young man to whom many of the sonnets are addressed? Was he the person who gave Thomas Thorpe, the publisher, a manuscript copy? And what my own research suggested by looking at other pamphlets and books of the time is that it's a simple misprint, that the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Master W.H., was probably intended to be to the only begetter of these ensuing sonnets, Master W.S.H., i.e. Shakespeare himself, the man who wrote them.
Thereby going back to one of the rules of thumb of conspiracy theories, never rule out stupidity.
Yeah, in this case, a misprint seemed to have generated more literary commentary than perhaps the sonnets themselves.
But then you went on to this other work, W.S., and this was a funeral elegy that, well, it turned out to be a murder mystery of its own.
Yes, this is a poem that hadn't received any critical or scholarly attention prior to my looking at it, and it's easy to see why. On a first reading, it's long and very long, not eminently Shakespearean. It's not Shakespeare as you like it, but it's from the first page registers its acquaintance with Shakespeare's manner. The dedication is modeled on Shakespeare's Rape of Lucrece, and as I began reading this poem back in 1984, I was struck by just how much Shakespeare was in it, and yet Shakespeare scholars had never discussed it.
How did you then go about finding a technique, literary forensics? Is this something that pre-existed your research?
I sometimes see myself credited as the inventor of new science, which is giving me more credit than I deserve. As early as the Lindbergh kidnapping, this kind of work was being performed by scholars for police and FBI and other investigators. The police detectives themselves had to do some of this kind of work. And in literary studies, it's been a field of research at least as far as the medieval period.
Take us through the elements of language and grammar and punctuation. What of those things do you use to try to identify an author?
Well, as in a crime, no single line of a fingerprint would be decisive. No single bit of linguistic evidence should be described as a stylistic fingerprint, as a phrase that sometimes is used for this kind of work. It does take a pattern of evidence. So I begin just by assuming that nothing is irrelevant. I look at spelling, punctuation, diction, use and misuse of standard use and misuse of various words, the syntax, that is, the way the sentences are put together, reading material that has contributed to the text. In the case of A Funeral Elegy, it included even, for example, some manuscript works that were known to be in possession of Shakespeare's dramatic company. And in some cases where such information is available, the formatting on the printed page or typewritten page, the manner in which the ideas are assembled and try to extract from the evidence a balanced case both for and against the possible suspects.
Was there one element that finally was the straw that broke this literary camel's back?
It was in 1995 that I finally was willing to say that the evidence seemed quite compelling that Shakespeare must be the author of this text, and some other scholars joined me in that conclusion. And so in January of 1996, I suddenly found the elegy for William Peter front page news in the New York Times.
But it was weight of evidence and no single smoking gun.
No, I'd say even today there's not a smoking gun. If it were absolutely conclusive, we would find, I guess you would say, universal consent among Shakespeare scholars. But there still have been a number of efforts to find someone else who might fit the bill. So far, no other candidate has emerged.
Not even Queen Elizabeth.
Well, it depends on whom you ask. Some will tell you that Queen Elizabeth or Francis Bacon or Christopher Marlowe not only wrote this poem, but Hamlet and King Lear.
Don Foster is my guest. He analyzes words, grammar, punctuation, and syntax to identify authors of anonymous material. He's written a book called Author Unknown. Your book is subtitled On the Trail of Anonymous, and that could be taken as a direct reference to one of the more celebrated cases that you've been involved in, and that is the author of Primary Colors, Anonymous.
Well, it was just when the New York Times featured its story on A Funeral Elegy that Random House released Primary Colors, and it shot straight to the top of the sales charts. So as I was fielding calls about A Funeral Elegy from press and news organizations around the world, suddenly I also began getting calls who wrote Primary Colors. While I hadn't read Primary Colors and didn't really think I could be of any help at all, but New York Magazine was persistent and kept calling back saying, we really like you to help us out here in identifying who is anonymous. And finally I gave it the old college try.
That's a great philosophical question. Who is anonymous? But it was a specific question in this case, and it took you about a week.
Well, I couldn't have done it that quickly without help from the editors of New York Magazine, who kept sending me electronic text by possible suspects, Michael Kelly and Lisa Grunewald and Gary Trudeau and Christopher Buckley, one after another, whom I examined and had to rule out with some discouragement, finally thinking I wasn't going to find myself who wrote Primary Colors.
Listeners may not remember, but this was a cause célèbre at the time. It was a big controversy over who was the author of this book, and it was the best-selling book at the time.
Anonymous was a much bigger deal for many Washington reporters than Shakespeare, because after all, it appeared that the book might have been written by a journalist, someone close to Clinton, and it became a wonderful guessing game. It was a very lively novel, and it seemed to be a roman en clef in which each of the characters, or at least each of the main characters, was either a politician or a pundit or someone on the inside track. So it was a tremendous hit with journalists, as with the public at large.
There was a Washington Post list of, I think it was 35 possible suspects, and I think they listed Joe Klein as 50 to 1. In the event, you found a strong clue as to the true identity of Anonymous in the very first line of the book.
Well, the Post's odds for Joe Klein were 50 to 1 against, so he's not someone that I looked at right away. When I began my work, I simply began looking for vocabulary. What other journalist, political novelist uses words that appear in Primary Colors, and began with the most unusual ones. It wasn't until near the end of my work, which is where I put this bit of evidence in my article as well, that found what might be read as kind of a hidden self-disclosure in the opening lines of the book. The narrator of the novel is a black man, Henry Burton, And he tells his readers, "I am small and not so dark." And I thought I saw in that, after finding that Joe Klein was the likely author of Primary Colors, that it was kind of an in-joke. "I am small." Klein is the German word for small. "I am Klein, and I'm not really black."
One of the problems you write is that when you're identifying long-dead poets, they're not going to stand up and deny their authorship.
Well, in this case, my suspect wasn't dead, and he did stand up and say, "It's not me. I didn't do it. This is silly."
And you were then excoriated and even subsequently had your own moments of doubt.
Well, it did take me back at first when Joe Klein went on national television and on CBS and again in Newsweek, his two employers backing him up, saying that he was not the author and that I had made a big mistake. And for the next 6 months, we're a little tense as Shakespeareans debated why they should believe Shakespeare wrote a rather dull funeral poem, if in fact I also said that Joe Klein had written Primary Colors and got that wrong.
And in fact, one of the reasons you had undertaken this project was to vindicate the techniques you'd applied to Shakespeare.
Well, this was my idea. It didn't seem to be working out too well. It seemed in January and February and March of 1996 as if I had made a bad career move with that attribution.
Also, you seem to believe that Joe Klein, as a nationally prominent journalist, wouldn't flat-out lie, and in fact, his sort of semi-denials of being the author before your article appeared in New York Magazine, those equivocations were one of the things that led you toward him, or at least added to the body of evidence.
After coming to the conclusion that Joe Klein wrote Primary Colors, I had to look and see what, in fact, he had said on this subject, and the only denials I could find seemed pretty equivocal to me, which at least I took some reassurance in the thought that he wouldn't come out and say, "No, this is wrong." But in fact, that's how it turned out.
So when the press conference happened and Joe Klein came out and said, "I'm Joe Klein and I am the author of Primary Colors," suddenly this 6 months that you had gone through of being challenged not only on your identification of Joe Klein, but on the whole Shakespearean issue before that, you were suddenly the most prominent literary attribution man on the planet.
Well, I had more or less ducked out of sight, not returning calls about this. I was a little weary of Primary Colors after 6 months of stressful consideration whether I ought to at least to have bit my tongue and not made the attribution. But other investigators, police and prosecutors, defenders, lawyers saw in the work that I had done a practical application for the work that they often do that had never really considered myself, which is that there are many anonymous and questioned documents out there in the real world that need an author as well.
My guest is Don Foster. His new book is Author Unknown, On the Trail of Anonymous. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Don Foster, a Shakespearean scholar and literary gumshoe. His new book is titled Author Unknown. Most of us can probably recite 'Twas the Night Before Christmas without missing more than a sugar plum or two. The famous poem was written by Clement Moore, but it turns out that there has long been another claim to the authorship of this poem, and Don Foster has most recently found himself on the front page of the New York Times in an article discussing the authorship of The Visit by St. Nicholas.
Well, Neil, if you had asked me a year ago who wrote The Night Before Christmas, I would have said Clement Clark Moore. Then one hot August afternoon, I received a phone call from a woman who identified herself as Mary Van Dusen, the great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter of Henry Livingston, a name that meant nothing to me. But Henry Livingston was, in fact, a sometime resident of my hometown and a soldier in the Revolutionary War. His family, as far back as his own children, have claimed that it was he, not Clement Clark Moore, who wrote The Night Before Christmas, and that an injustice has been done that was not yet corrected, and I was called in to investigate this problem.
Well, you're called in on a lot of things. What differentiated this from, you'll excuse, from crackpots?
Well, I get far more requests than I can usually assist with, and in this case, I was inclined to politely decline, but Mary Van Dusen was quite persistent and read a bit of Moore's verse, a little bit of Henry Livingston, told me some of the story, and I was at the time writing my book, Author Unknown, and I thought, well, there might be a story here. As it turned out to be, it turned out to be a much bigger story, more interesting story than I could have anticipated.
Where did the trail lead you?
Well, at first it led only to a dead end, a family legend. What do you do with that? And some verses by Livingston that sounded quite a bit like Night Before Christmas, and some verses by Moore that sounded nothing at all like The Night Before Christmas. There were stories of the two suspects' characters and lives. Henry Livingston was a jovial man who gave out gifts of wine to the Indians at Christmas time and who actually banqueted them. He was a poet for children. He sketched pictures for children and was an all-around well-loved man. Cummin Clark Moore was a Bible scholar, a fine man, quite stodgy, one even might say a little bit curmudgeonly, whose verse was of a much more severe and moralizing variety. But none of that finally constituted evidence. And after spending a couple of weeks on this problem, I was ready to bail on it. And when finally some additional documents rehooked my interest, and by the time that trail led to its conclusion, I found myself confronted with the unavoidable conclusion that Henry Livingston, in fact, was the author of this poem, and Cummin Clark Moore an imposter.
And again, what was the straw that broke the... let me mix my metaphors here. What was the straw that broke the smoking gun?
Well, it was a twisted trail that led me to the Poughkeepsie Journal, where much of Livingston's verse was published, and to the New York Historical Society Library, and hither and yon. The evidence for Livingston's authorship and the evidence against Moore's continued to mount. I guess what finally did it for me was the argument that Moore could not tell a lie. He was a Bible professor. He would not have accepted the credit for this poem if, in fact, he didn't write it. And what I found in looking at Moore's track record is not only that he would, but did, and in fact, at one point late in life, even took credit for another man's entire book.
Very few of us would know anything by Clement Moore, or allegedly by Clement Moore, other than "Twas the Night Before Christmas." But at the time, I guess he was a regularly published writer.
Well, like many poets of the time, much of his poetry was published anonymously under the pseudonym L and various other, even though his name was Moore. And it was not poetry that was particularly engaging. Goes something like this: shame, shame, heart-rending thought, deep sinking stain, that Britain's and Columbia's fair should deign, nay, strive their native beauties to enhance by arts first taught by prostitutes of France. That's more on cosmetics. And on almost every subject, he's quite severe in censuring the sinfulness of his fellow Americans. He wrote one prose tract denouncing Thomas Jefferson as a danger to the Commonwealth. Hmm. And one finds in Henry Livingston a very different spirit. In fact, the two men disagreed on almost every topic. Livingston was for public education. Moore was against it. Livingston favored the education of women. Moore opposed it. Livingston was opposed to slavery. Moore owned slaves. And so it makes Livingston the emotional favorite. And in this case, the evidence finally led to Livingston's door as well. And I think his family will be glad that his claim has finally been vindicated.
But when Moore made his claim, wasn't there anybody around to say, like Joe Klein, I did it?
Well, Livingston himself was long dead by the time this Night Before Christmas became associated with Moore's name. When it was associated with Clement Moore's name, he said nothing for many, many years. And meanwhile, the poem made him famous. In 1844, this is now almost 40 years after the poem was first written, almost 30 years after it was, well, a little more than 30 years after it was, after its first extant publication, he published The Night Before Christmas with his poems and quietly accepted credit for it.
Do you feel that you have now established the techniques that you have used as a science as precise as fingerprinting or as precise as DNA to absolutely identify the authors of certain works?
Neil, that's an interesting question. The comparison of linguistic evidence to DNA or fingerprint analysis is a common one, and I think not inappropriate, but there are limitations to any metaphor. And in this case, I would have to say that that scientific evidence of the kind that has proved itself again and again and again in fingerprint work and DNA work has to be considered more decisive. If we had Henry Livingston's fingerprints on an original manuscript of The Night Before Christmas, I don't think there would have to be any reason for a chapter on this controversy in my book.
Is there any area of literary controversy that you think is now ripe for this kind of analysis?
Well, in literary studies, there's some new controversy that arises every year, most recently one involving Ernest Hemingway. I'm content in future, I think, to let other literary scholars duke it out over these kinds of problems. I've got, I guess I'm feeling the desire to take a little bit of a break from text analysis and literary attribution to try my hand at some other kinds of endeavors.
Back to Shakespeare.
Well, back to Shakespeare and back to the classroom. I teach at Vassar. I have wonderful students there, and it's really the study of literary texts and the experience of the classroom that I entered literary studies for, and it's to that that I would like to return.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Don Foster's book is Author Unknown, On the Trail of Anonymous. He's a professor of English literature at Vassar College.